FNG, this is your rack. Keep it made and sleep on top of the covers. This is your dresser. This, your wall locker. Keep them locked. There's only one thief around here. Everyone else is just trying to get their stuff back. This is the shop. Be here tomorrow morning dressed to run. If you fall out of a run, God help you. This is how to cut your own hair. This is how to roll your sleeves. This is how to blouse your boots. This is how to wear your cover. This is how to salute. Always keep your right hand free in case you need to salute. These are your friends now. Memorize their names and hometowns. This is town. This is where we eat when we go to town. This is where we drink when we go to town. They don't ask for ID, so don't worry. You buy the first round until we get a new guy. Never fight here. If you do fight here, don't get caught. If you get caught, call me first. I'll bail you out, but God help you. This is your weapon. Break it down shotgun style and check the bolt. Reassemble and do function check. If it's good, memorize the serial number. BZO it and memorize the BZO. When you go to the rifle range, shoot expert. If you can't shoot expert, shoot sharpshooter for sure. This is your fire team. You're the smallest guy, so you're the rifleman. When you're on point, your eyes and sights are connected. If you look where your rifle isn't, God help you. If you see something, hear something, get a bad feeling about anything, say so. Any little thing could be the difference. This is how to lace your boots so we can cut them off if we need to. Label all your clothes in case we can't identify you any other way. This is your poncho. It's also a tent, a roof, a blanket, a pillow, a windbreak, a bag, a sail. Carry it everywhere. This is deployment. Don't write home too much. Don't think about home. When they shoot, make yourself small. Make sure you can identify an IED. This is how you breach a door. This is your sector of fire. Always assault towards an ambush. Don't freeze. This is combat. Don't freak out. This is how you tie a tourniquet. This is how you treat a sucking chest wound. Breathing is more important than bleeding. Start the breathing, stop the bleeding, protect the wound, treat for shock. Nothing works in this place. This is how you wrap a body in a poncho. It is also a shroud. Don't freak out. This is home. Don't try to get it all back in one day. Give yourself time. Give your family time. Don't hurt anyone. Don't hurt yourself. Talk to us because we're the only ones who'll get it anyway. See you tomorrow.
Don't freak out. I've always wondered about that. How do you not?
I think there was actually a poem that didn't make the cut for this book that it kind of broke my heart that it didn't. And it was about compartmentalization and the idea of compartments in your mind where, you allow yourself to freak out for about a second and a half and then you stuff it someplace else and just function. It's just a matter of function. And they always said, the drill instructors and everyone always says, that in times like that, you revert to the level of your training. You're not a thinking person at that point. You're just a trained person. So I guess that's how you don't freak out.
I've always heard, too, that when you're in combat, you actually end up fighting more for yourself, for your family, for the person next to you, not so much a political idea or a government or this huge concept of freedom. Do you relate to that?
Certainly, the justifications are the last thing on your mind, basically the entire time that you're there, really. But certainly, in any kind of combat situation, the why of it doesn't enter into your head. It's not a factor. It's just so much of winning a fight is the willingness to accept that you're in it. And I think presence of mind is a huge part of that. So you just don't have time for the justification and who's right, who's wrong. You just know in this moment that someone is going to have to.
Tell us something about your background, Bruce. Are you a native of the area? Or
I was born and raised in the Jackson area. I actually went to Alma College in Alma, Michigan for 2 years, 2000 and 2001. Uh-huh. And then, September 11th happened, and Alma College campus got really kind of weird. Everyone was scared in a way. Before that, in my lifetime, terrorism was not a thing that had really touched the United States I think the biggest thing were the hostages in
During Jimmy Carter's time?
Right, yes, yeah. Right. Just the last day of Carter's presidency, right? And I think that was even before I was born, but it was certainly in the national consciousness. But for me and my generation, we hadn't factored that an awful lot until September 11th. And then, like I said, people got strange, as if Alma, Michigan was going to be the next terror target. Mm. Like they're coming here next. And,
yeah,
you know, there were other factors. It's a long story, but the weirdness on campus and me wanting to assert myself as my own man, mm-hmm. you know, for the first time led to me dropping out, joining the Marines. And
so you enlisted?
I did, yeah.
Yeah.
And it was a spur of the moment kind of thing.
And Marines, why Marines? What attracted you to that?
To be honest, there is a little bit of a family history. My father's father was a Marine. He fought in Korea, but he died when I was about 4 years old. I don't have too many memories of him, so I can't even point to that as a huge factor. But I figured if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do it this way. You know, there was the perception in my head that the Marines are going to be the ones that are going to best prepare me for this. I mean, the writing was on the wall even in 2001. You know,
yeah,
our country responds this way. We're going to war.
Yeah.
So might as well be a Marine.
I've always heard that there's no such thing as a retired Marine.
Yes, they say former Marine, right? Never ex-Marine, just former Marine, as if, you know, I'm always ready to be back in it or something. But I'm okay with that. You hear a lot of things from civilians, and ex-Marine is one of the least offensive, you know? So I'm not bothered by the term. But the mentality, certainly, I think is maybe what they're talking about. And there are aspects of that that never go away.
Right. The changes that happen, I can't imagine that they ever go away.
Well, I mean, they engineer you in a certain way. Part of that whole leading back to the how do you function question, starting day one of boot camp, they are overwhelming you. They're giving you circumstances that you are not prepared for. You have no analog in your previous life for the things that happen day one, minute one of boot camp. So you learn that, you know, your body and your mind are two different things. Your body will function when your mind is not.
So that's your journey, at least the beginning of it as a Marine. What about your journey as a writer?
Okay. Well, I always knew I wanted to write. It was a thing, you know, from like the first class I ever took in sixth grade that got me writing was like a journalism class for the little, it wasn't a newspaper, it was a newsletter for my middle school, but I loved it. And I took journalism throughout high school. I knew I wanted to write, but I ran up against that problem when I was 18, 19 years old of having nothing to write about. You know, I didn't think I had anything to write about. And part of that frustration is probably also what led me to go in the Marines. Like, I want to change my life. I want to get some experience that most people don't have that I would otherwise never have, and maybe I'll write about it that way. And, you know, my father was supportive of it because I was good at it, but also didn't really understand that it's kind of an unquantifiable pursuit for a long time. You know, my dad is an accountant. He is not that creative. Creativity in his profession is a crime, you know? So part of that justification was, you know, I'm going to join the Marines and write about it later. But
now, usually, and I could be wrong about this, when I think Marine and I think about literature, I'm usually thinking novels, memoirs, prose, not so often poetry. Not that poetry is a soft thing. It can be a sucker punch. Why poetry rather than prose?
Well, to be honest, I thought I would be a prose writer, and I got out of the Marines. I moved to Western Michigan with my wife, who was not my wife yet, but we moved out here, and I started going to Western Michigan here, and I was taking all the intro writing classes, and, you know, thank God for intro to creative writing. They make you do both disciplines. Excuse me. They make you do the creative nonfiction a little bit and poetry and fiction. And it turns out, given an infinite amount of space in fictitious characters to manipulate, I will just make a mess of everything. And part of the compression of poetry, I think, was mimetic of the kind of mental compression that you have to go through as a Marine. And I just noticed that at that time, the poetry was serving me far better. And, you know, when you go on to graduate school, you have to specialize. There aren't many graduate schools or any that I'm aware of that allow you to be like a fiction writer, poet, nonfiction, and just take a general. So you do have to specialize. And certainly my poetry profile was strongest when application time came around. It got me into the University of Michigan. So
now writing art in general, I think, is often talked about as therapy. Was writing about your experience in Iraq therapy, and or was it a way to connect with other people that were there with you, or people in general who have been through that experience?
I think it was definitely, I didn't think of it as therapy because obviously, right, you don't want to admit that you're the kind of person that might need therapy, but of course, maybe everyone does, right?
I think so.
So I got out of the Marines, met the woman who was going to be my wife, and realized that though I was functioning, I thought, very well as a single person, when sharing your life with another person, you need to get your stuff together a little bit more. You know, it doesn't affect anyone else if I wake up in the middle of the night three or four or five times if I live by myself. I just wake up, do what I got to do, go back to sleep.
Right.
When there's another person, there's a level of accountability, and you feel like if I'm going to make a life, I've got to start getting better. So
yeah,
I started writing.
And did it work that way for you, help you make sense of the irrational?
Sure. I mean, it's not like flipping a light switch, you know, like, oh, I started writing and everything is fine.
Yeah.
But of course, it's a way to start getting your mind around it. And I think with poems, since they're such small, discrete units, you can start with just a tiny corner that you can get your hands on, you know, and you can kind of suss out what there is for that. Maybe it leads you to another one. And a lot of these poems, as I look back on them, I see the inciting image. Usually it's an image for me, or a sound, or a very specific that then blows up into the rest of the poem.
And talking with a veteran friend of mine, I'd asked him once, as a vet, what did he want from civilians? And it wasn't thank you for your service, and it wasn't the parades on Veterans Day. He said, in fact, some of that even annoyed him. But instead, he said, when we come back, give us the help we need, the homeless vets, or if we need medical or psychological help, give that to us. And it wasn't about the other. What do you feel like? What do you want from civilians when you come back home?
I understand the thought behind the phrase, thank you for your service. And depending on who it comes from, it's okay. But I think that's kind of almost a phrase that's been politicized a little bit, and it means something. But also, I think there are people that believe that thank you for your service then absolves them of any other obligation to you as a veteran, which is fine. But what I want most as a veteran is just understanding, not even acknowledgement, just understanding, like, this is what we have done at the behest of the American people. It wasn't our idea. You know, 20,000 19-year-olds didn't just decide on their own initiative to go and be in Fallujah, Iraq, but there we were. So I think my book and the readings that I do and the talks that I do are mostly about starting a dialogue. When I do readings in public, I love to do a question and answer afterward because that gets the dialogue going. Otherwise, I'm just speaking at these people, which, while it may be effective, is not as effective as having that conversation. So I think, yeah, definitely we want just the understanding, and I think everything else will flow from that. Once people understand our circumstances in our situation, they'll give to these organizations that exist to provide supports that maybe we don't even know that we need. And you never expect to need, but sometimes you're just too far in it to get out on your own.
So what do you hope that your reader will get from your work? And I'm wondering, too, do you see your reader more as the general public, or do you see them as other veterans, or maybe all of that?
Well, I think a lot of my work originates in anger initially, and it's usually something that has resulted from that breakdown of communication with civilians, because that's certainly the hardest part about getting home. When you're still in the military, you're with your unit. There are ready built support system of people that have shared the same experiences, and it's kind of a perfect self-supporting thing. But when you get out, I mean, getting out of the military is like dying. You do it alone. You're all of a sudden just surrounded by people that have no idea where you've been and what you've done and what has been expected of you. And that's a jarring transition. So a lot of my poems were just writing towards like these people with whom I feel like I have less and less in common, or I felt like I, you know, my wife calls it Operation Civilian Assimilation, right? And I think it's going better. I'm progressing in that. You know, but a lot of these arise from some kind of miscommunication or some kind of frustration at not being able to communicate.
In your poem, in Get Some was the title, your opening line was, "It terrifies me that I miss it." Do you? And you're talking about that bonding that happens.
Absolutely. I mean, I guess I don't miss it enough to still be in. So there's that. I mean, any active duty military member could call me on that. How much do you really miss it? Well, not enough to be doing it all the time. It just wasn't for me anymore. But absolutely, there's something about just that kind of closeness where you, and I think the military is not the only place you can find that, but that kind of closeness where there's very little margin for error and the things that happen are immediate and intense, and you reach a level of understanding that you will only have with those 7 or 8 or 10 people. It's, of course you would miss that. But, you know, more importantly, it's, well, not more importantly at all, but I guess tangentially, it's very exciting to not be killed when someone is trying to kill you. You know, you feel euphoric for a moment, and then you immediately crash into the reality of what's just happened. But there is that initial rush of like, I can't believe that I am still alive. It's a great feeling to be still alive rather than just alive. You just feel good. You feel 20 pounds lighter all of a sudden. Like for just a moment, the heat and the weight of everything you're carrying and just all those other outside factors are not just lifted from you. They're like a blessing to even experience because you're still alive.
Have you gotten any responses yet from other veterans on your book, or is it too soon since publication to ask?
I have, and I'm always nervous every time another vet reads my book of how they're going to take it and what they're going to take from it in a much different way than civilians. I mean, you know, when you write a book that everyone is going to interpret it in their own way, and they're going to kind of look at it through the lens of their own experience and their own expectations of you as a veteran and as a Marine and a Marine who decided to write a book of poetry. People have ideas about what they're going to get before they even open it. But I find it most nerve-wracking when veterans read it because, frankly, I care more what they think when they read it.
That makes sense.
So, yeah, some of the guys in my platoon, even, who are not the biggest readers in the world, have, you know, bought my book and read it. And so far, it's been positive. It's been very positive. Most of them are then sharing it with their loved ones as a kind of by proxy way of hopefully reaching some understanding, or at least starting a conversation that, you know, the people closest to you don't even know the questions to ask, maybe, but the book will then let them know what they don't know so they can ask the proper questions.
Begin building that understanding you spoke about.
Right.
There's a writing group of veterans over in Portage District Library. Are you involved in that at all?
I have not been yet.
You've heard about it?
I have heard about it, and it's I'm sure it's an interesting bunch, and I'd love to get in there and see. But just been awfully busy lately trying to write another
17-month-old
write
son.
Another book, and yes, I have a baby boy who is just, I lovingly refer to him as my little tyrant. He doesn't care about, you know, if daddy really figured out how to express that last stanza. He's not interested in that. He just wants to eat, sleep, play. Mostly play, you know. So I would love to get out there and get with those men and women in that veterans writing group and see what they're up to. But I have not yet.
What are you working on now?
Well, yeah, that's the burning question, right? As soon as you finish a book, people are like, what about book two? Well, I'm writing creative nonfiction now. Loosely connected essays that are also about this military experience, which is a funny thing. There are some people that ask you, when are you going to be done? When are you going to be finished writing military stuff? You know, when are you going to have written past it? And I mean, the only answer to that is I have no idea. And it's kind of a strange question, I guess, to be asked, but it is a question I've been asked point blank to my face. When are you going to be done with this? I have no idea. So I'm writing nonfiction now. I think it's going very well. It's really great to also be a poet, because if I start getting bogged down in a nonfiction, I'll just flip and write poetry for a little while, and I'll flip back, and it's kind of a way to stay fresh and
very, very different writer's muscles you're using, I think.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. There's a different way you approach it when you know that you have to make a longer cohesive whole, and you worry about those, you know, those really artful thematic echoes that draw people through your nonfiction. Mm-hmm. And then there's the specter of Tim O'Brien, who wrote like the best military nonfiction ever. And everybody asks you, did you read Tim O'Brien? Have you read The Things They Carried? And you're like, well, of course I did. And at first I was utterly demoralized because it's beautiful and I don't think I can do that. But then I think maybe I should anyway. Should make the attempt.
You should. The work is powerful. Upcoming reading at Michigan News Agency. What can we expect to hear there?
Yes, it's June 16th from 6 to 8 p.m. at Michigan News Agency, and I think you're going to get some of the poems from the book. I don't like to read a whole bunch of poems from the book because I don't want to spoil it for folks that are
right.
going to read it or haven't read the whole thing yet. So I read some poems from the book, and I'm actually going to read some of my creative nonfiction and kind of weave those together. I think it's really interesting to see the way that they can hand off to one another. So we'll get both of that and hopefully some question and answer. I love to do Q&A at the end of these things.
You do. So what are the more common questions you get asked?
I'm not sure if I have like ready-made responses for the most common ones, but I remember the best ones, and some of them are, I was asked at Kalamazoo College, do I like violent video games?
Oh.
I do, as it turns out, because there's no consequence for anyone. You can do whatever you like, and it's definitely not an analog for military experience. I am of the video game generation, you know, everything from the Atari forward. I think I've been on those systems, and violent video games do not prepare you for the taking of life. I'm going to come out and say that.
I wonder in some ways if it does the opposite, desensitizes you.
Maybe. I mean, you're certainly not getting any kind of, in a real life situation, you just feel kind of awful the entire time. There's no prize, you know?
Yeah. And in some ways, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, it's something you can't really prepare for.
Absolutely. They even say that to us in the Marines, like from a person to person, even within the Marines, from Marine to Marine, you can be in the exact same circumstance, exact same situation, and have vastly different responses to it. And it just, there, as far as I know, there's no kind of screening or testing or anything that they can even do to predict that. You just have to go and see.
This may be a silly question, Bruce, but I've always wondered this. And my father has served in the military, too, and talked to me a little bit about this. When you first start, at least, it seems especially at the beginning, when you join in the military, there's this breaking down process, which can be even insulting, offensive, getting in your face. You write a little bit about that, getting in your face. Is that a team building? What's the idea behind that?
Well, you know, at first you're completely overwhelmed by it, and you think, maybe this was the worst decision I ever made in my life. I would get more sleep if I was in jail even than I am in boot camp, you know? But so at first you just are completely overwhelmed by your circumstances. You do nothing but fear the drill instructors, always fear. And then eventually it doesn't get better. You don't stop fearing the drill instructors, but you begin to hate them and you begin to want to spite them. And the only way that you can do that is as a team. You can all succeed. It's all of us against those three or four men who are the leading torment of our lives. We can do this together to spite them. And I think that's, I guess that's how they get you to run initially. There's a method to that madness, that level of spite. You can achieve great things, as it turns out.
I guess that's what I was wondering, is the method to the madness there of breaking down the individual and building up the team, which seems to be what you're describing.
As an individual in that circumstance, which is analogous, I guess, to a combat experience, you cannot help but be overwhelmed. It's too big. It's too much. No person in boot camp is just this perfectly compartmentalized island that has no trouble. And if they tell you that, they're lying. You must reach out to those other people that are suffering along with you. And that's, you know, I still remember every guy I went to boot camp with. If I saw them, I would know them. And we would have, you know, probably a moment or two where we recall the good stories, which is what you do after those terrible things. You remember the funny parts, not the everyday grinding fear and hunger and exhaustion. Mm-hmm. You remember the funny stuff. Like, you know, the time that somebody got their boots blown up, or, you know, somebody in boot camp ran into the drill instructor naked when he was coming out of the shower. And it was just this hilarious moment that none of us could laugh at the time. Certainly we'll laugh about it now.
If you could close with another of your poems, would love to hear another one.
Absolutely. This poem is called In Heaven There Are No Doors. If I am dead, I reject this heaven, the doors growing in numbers, stretching up and down, before and behind me, out of work in my combat loadout, downcast eyes on the downscale thresholds, desert prize fighters on the other sides. I'm reminded as my squadmate pushes me to breach, be empty, Lord, please, that the word threshold means also far as I can go and much as I can stand in these suspended instants when murder changes hands and we exchange fire with men no less strange than ourselves. In this heaven, hearts break over furnace streets that I try to wish out of existence. I gather shriveled leaves in handfuls and crush them into fragments. Suspended inside my gear, I stumble downhill in boiling boots toward the people with half faces above their scarves, hands hidden like despair is winning in this city of doors, of rooms to be cleared and quarters so close the shots travel backward through time, sweep men into history. What is it about these people? They never ever look up, just keep trying to stare themselves into the graces of a kinder God. It's so dry, everyone weeps blood. Wilson was killed by the roadside, frozen in flame. Hudson was killed in a turret, sprung in three places. Dean was killed by a collapsing pediment when this heaven began raining stone. Ordinary losses. When your number's up, you die, in a moment's exhilaration or choking to death on a lemon, and this heaven's unspooling faster than we can reel it back in, because in this heaven, hope is a function of effort. Heaven is not squat walls covered in broken glass, so utterly unhome, by which I mean shadowing my retinas, a dark backdrop blotting my day-to-day when life is the movie set and all's real behind my eyelids. The aperture sticks open and the film bleaches and burns. In a bar I like because no one speaks, I sit in the corner, put the table in front of me so everyone has to cross my sight line on their way up and back. Some don't even look. Just think, they don't even look my way, and I could be anyone with a steel needle and hummingbird's precision lunging across this table. I want to stress them until they snap. The ultimate tensile strength of self, like wire drawn thin too fast. It's called necking when you start to give in the middle, and there's no popping back now that the only life is other than your own. People who couldn't begin to understand talking down to you.
Thank you, Bruce.
Thank you.